This is an ABC podcast.
What goes on behind the scenes in Pacific politics and how does it affect us? Politalk is back to unpack the big questions like, why is it hard to get medicine you need in the Pacific?
It came to a point where he was admitted where he got blood poisoning. He needed antibiotics for that, and that was not available.
Join me, Scott Whitehair, on Politalk.
Search up Politalk in your favourite podcast app to listen.
This is Stories from the Pacific on ABC Radio Australia.
Hello and welcome to Stories from the Pacific on ABC Radio Australia. I'm Bobby McCumber. Today I'm speaking with Elizabeth Kuroi-Vula'ono, a film producer, documentary director and visual storyteller based in Auckland, New Zealand. Born in Mutuku Lau, raised in Suva, Fiji, her work beautifully captures authentic voices and lived experiences of people from the Pacific, infusing them with heart and integrity through an Indigenous lens. A powerful example of her work as a producer and director is the captivating original documentary from Coconut TV, The Forgotten Pacific. But outside of her work, Elizabeth's journey is a tale of creativity, self-discovery, and moving from a home where she considered herself part of the majority to another country where she was considered a minority. Lizzie, welcome to Stories from the Pacific.
Nisam Pulavanaka, Bobby.
You initially wanted to be a marine biologist. What inspired that initial interest?
I've always loved the ocean. And when I was born, my parents are teachers. So they used to teach in the outer islands of Fiji. So we were always surrounded by water. And I think just kind of by osmosis, I grew a love for the ocean. So I thought to myself, oh, what can I do? How do I be in the ocean as a job, as an office? And then I stumbled upon, you know, marine biology. I was like, oh, cool, I can do that. I can be that. It's swimming around and, you know, looking at things under the ocean. So that's what led me down the path in terms of trying to study it. To my dismay, I failed biology in sixth form. And I thought to myself, I really thought I was good. And then it came and I got like 48 out of 100. And I was like, oh, I really can't do this. Because if this is just, you know, beginner level biology, what am I going to do when it gets to like undergrad? And I was like, okay, let's just save me all of this pain and hassle.
How did you feel when you came to that realization?
Do you know, I really laughed at myself because I thought to myself, I was like, man, you really thought you could get in from class one to... fifth form, was I ever great in science? But I was so adamant. I was like, oh, I can do this. I think it's just biology I have to get past. Then I realized, I was like, actually, it's not just biology. There's a lot more included. I really did. I was so, honestly, I think I came home and I was telling my sisters and they said the same thing. They were like, well, we didn't want to tell you that you weren't doing great. And I was like, yeah, no, I don't know why no one told me I wasn't doing great. I wasted 2 years of my life studying a subject that really, you know, it took the brain cells out of me.
So you, around the age of 13, you got a part-time job as an auto queue operator through your auntie. How did that come about?
She had come home one day and she realized we were all bored because there were all five of us there. I think maybe I was lucky because I was the one at home. But I think because I was at home, she just asked me and I was like, oh, yeah, I can do that job. Like, it's no problem. I got paid $35 a week.
Oh, wow.
First day, yeah. And I thought I was so rich. And then on my first paycheck, my parents come to me and they're like, oh, you have to contribute to the bills. And I'm like, just my $35. So half went to them every week. So I really, yeah. I was like, man, $35, right? And I used to get it in a little brown paper bag, a little brown envelope, just cash.
Yeah. So how did your auntie help steer you into the world of media? And what was it like operating the auto queue as a high school student?
You know, I think it was because of her that I saw that there was this other field that I could do. Because I actually didn't think past marine biology. I was like, oh, I'll just figure out, you know, when I finish sixth form and I go into university and I see what university has to offer, then I'll figure something out. But it really was my auntie who like took me to the TV station. And when I started to see all the different kind of roles that in terms of like production and shooting and editing, it was like I started to get very excited about potentially doing something like that. And for UltraQ, it was, you know, it was hard. Eh? It's not an easy job. And we used an older system. And I used to go to work in my school uniform. So every day after school, I'd work from like 4 to 6:30 for the first news. And then when I got great, then they promoted me to do the 10 p.m. news. So I would do 6 p.m. and 10 p.m. And I'd like get home at like 11 and I'd shower and change and sleep and I'd go to school the next day. So I did that all through like from third form all the way up until sixth form. And because of that, I also learned to edit on the non-linear machines. So tape to tape. Yeah. So like when I was like 16 and 17, like one of my highlights, like in terms of having that after school job was learning to edit tape to tape, which is where I had to put a tape into one deck, spin the spool, time mark in, mark out, and that particular part of the tape would go into another tape. So you couldn't make a mistake because if you had to go back, you had to erase everything and redub over that tape. And we like edit on like the beta cams.
Wow.
Yeah. Like it's one of the things I was proud of in terms of my high school learnings from having like a holiday job. So I did UltraQ, then I got to learn editing, then I moved in, did some graphics. Then they promoted me to be the tape player. And then I just kept moving up and a couple of times they let me direct the news.
Get it. How old were you when you first directed the news?
I was 18.
Wow.
Yeah. It was scary because at the time, I'm a very tiny build, you know? Tiny human being. This is why my handle is the way it is. But yes, you know, surrounded by all of these like media people who have been in the industry long. But I guess it's just because I showed kind of enthusiasm and I was curious. They're like, oh, you could give it a go. So I did a couple of those. And through working at Fiji TV, I got to like be the cable runner for some of the international rugby matches. They came to the stadium. I did some vision switching for rugby, did some camera. Like I was blessed to be able to do quite a lot of things before I even came to study this particular field.
Incredible. So much experience, hands-on experience at such a young age. So while you were in Fiji, you realised that there were no higher education options available for film and television studies, which eventually landed you in Christchurch, New Zealand. You're now living in a predominantly white community, completely different from the home that you know. What motivated your decision to move to Christchurch, New Zealand, as opposed to another city or country?
When I applied for the course that the broadcasting school offered. It was the strongest one for me because I applied to the broadcasting school, UOA, AUT. I applied to a couple of other New Zealand universities. And when the offer letters came through and I read kind of their curriculum breakdown, the broadcasting school was a more practical-based learning, which was what I was very used to and what I'd come from. And then when I looked at the others and it was theory-based, I was like, It wasn't a calling card for me. Like, it didn't pull me towards that. So I chose this degree in this place based off of the strong curriculum. And also, I'm a big Christchurch, like Canterbury Crusader fan. And that was Christchurch was the home of the Crusaders. And I was like, so excited to finally come and watch them with my eyes live. So, you know, it had some sway when it came to deciding. Because funnily enough, my family were like, oh, why don't you go to Auckland? And I was like, oh, it's theory based and, you know, it's not really my thing. And they're like, you know, but it's a big Pacific community. And I didn't know what that meant because I just was like, I'm coming from Fiji. It's quite naive in terms of coming into a predominantly Kiwi white neighborhood, you know, white city. So I didn't realize what they meant, but I was like, oh no, but the Crusaders, they play in Christchurch and I can watch them. Every time they play at home, I'll be available to watch them because I only ever watched them on TV. And I'm like, I've watched rugby since I was like 5.
You moved from Fiji to Christchurch. What cultural changes did you experience and how ready did you feel for them?
You know, I don't think I was ready at all for any of the changes that I was about to like undergo or any of the things that was going to be new to me. I also, like when I applied to come to uni and I got accepted, I didn't actually think that I was coming. I was just going through the motion, right? And then my aunt's like, okay, you're going to go. And I'm like, where? Christchurch. And I was like, all of a sudden, you know, I started to get so homesick. This is 4 months out. I'm so homesick. And when I first applied to come to this course, I applied in 2006 for the 2007 intake, but the coup happened. So I had to wait a whole year because New Zealand banned Fiji travelers.
Wow.
So I waited a whole year and I came in the 2008 intake. So when that happened, I was kind of semi-furious, but I was like, oh, I have another year. Then I thought to myself, oh, it's another year. I probably won't go. But then, you know, 2008 came around and then off I was coming to study. And I'd come by myself. And I think the first thing that kind of shocked me was the weather.
Yeah.
More than anything, I was not prepared for the weather, number one. Number two was I wasn't prepared to see less of my community. So those are the major two things. Because with the weather, before I was, you know, confident enough to ask my classmates about this layer dressing, I just heard them say, oh, you have to wear layers. I was like, oh, cool. That means like I just wear like five T-shirts. So, you know, I go home, I come to school the next day, I wear all my T-shirts under my jumper, you know, thinking, oh, yeah, cool, layers. Couple of socks, you know, a few T-shirts, and then I was still cold. And then I think I grew confidence maybe like 3 months later. And then I asked them, so they explained to me what that meant. You know, so off I went and got a puffer jacket. And then I was like, oh, what is this magic of many colors? But yes, the weather was first and foremost the thing that shocked me the most. And then just seeing, like, not a lot of Pacific community or colored people. I just looked around and I was like, oh, this is quite interesting.
Yeah.
Is how I felt, yes.
How do you think these challenges enhanced your voice and purpose in your creative work?
You know, at the beginning, because I was a student and I was studying, I was in a different season and just kind of going through the motion of learning and trying to grasp everything I needed. But like now in this kind of later part of my journey, I look back and I'm like, I'm so grateful to have that, to have done that and lived there, because now I see the importance of having Indigenous-focused, Fijian-focused visibility in whatever shape and form it presents, whether it's like doco, drama, a music video, even like social content. Like that visibility matters. Because back then, you kind of talked about it, but it wasn't so needed as now, like in the movements that we're having now, where it is so much more important. But yeah, now like I see the need for more stories and visibility of different cultures, different voices, different sounds, different language. People don't know what they don't know. Some are just ignorant, and those are the ones we just can't help, right? Because you just won't be able to help them. But for the ones that don't know what they know, until you show them and they know, then you're like, okay. And to show them comes in the form of the kind of work that we do, the pieces of work that we present, print, visual medium, theater. These days, people we're learning more visually than we did like over 10, 15 years ago. You know, you see something, people are like, oh, they're a little bit more moved now. A lot more impact, a lot more social awareness. Yeah, so I mean, I am glad to have that. Christchurch, I love Christchurch. It's a beautiful city. If I could, of course I would live there again. It's flat. It's full of nature. And, you know, I got used to the cold. And that aside, like, you should be able to live anywhere in the world, regardless of minority or majority. Like, if you know you have a purpose in that space, you will make it work. You will move forward.
Through all of the shifts, from embracing your identity to navigating a new culture and building a career in media, was there a moment, whether at university or later in the workforce, where you finally felt like you had found your place in New Zealand?
Yes. You know, Christchurch, it helped with my resilience and, you know, it shaped my confidence, my bravery in terms of dealing with where you're somewhere with less visibility and realizing the need for more. You know, so that's like, that's what Christchurch did. And like, when I moved to Auckland, and I work now at a company called Tiki Lounge, which is predominantly Pacific creatives. This is where I most found my place in New Zealand, like found home, because I said, I'm surrounded by other Pacific creatives. We all have the same goal, more Pacific content, more Indigenous content. And that I've been with them for 9 years. And every year gets exciting because we try and push the bar, do more things that inclusive of all the Pacific, inclusive of all the groupings of, you know, Oceania. So this finally then 9 years ago, but prior to that, I was just learning and working in a lot of mainstream production houses that was teaching me things, making me strong, making me thick skinned, you know, making me realize, I was like, I have a bigger picture. So I got to go through you to get to my bigger picture.
You're listening to Stories from the Pacific on ABC Radio Australia. I'm Bobby McCumber, and I'm speaking with Elizabeth Kuroi-Vulono. Now, Lizzie, as if discovering your identity through the lens of race wasn't enough, another layer of self-discovery was quietly unfolding. It was during this time around 2008 that you had come to the terms with your attraction to women. Now, coming from a strong Catholic and conservative background, were there any thoughts that influenced the way you processed your feelings and identity at the time?
You know, to be honest, my sexuality is like the least and most exciting thing about me. The most exciting thing about me is the way that I love my mum and my siblings, my nieces and nephews, my partner, my friends in my community. And, you know, I have been blessed and privileged to be honest about and proud of who I am for like 17 years. And when I owned that pillar of who I am, it was very liberating. You know, and they say when you're starting to kind of become brave, pick somebody to start telling, to say the words aloud. So I picked a really close friend of mine and I said it. You know, and as I said it, it had less power of trying to be like scared to talk about it. So I started with her and then I told my sisters. And then I've always been comfortable with my sisters. And since I moved to New Zealand, we've created such a strong relationship because I've had to, because I don't live at home, you know, so I don't see the day to day. So we built our relationship, our adult sisterhood on trust and transparency and just honesty, vulnerability, all of it. You know, so I told them and they were excited for me, but they also laughed at me, but excited for me nonetheless.
Why did they laugh?
Yeah, they laughed at me because they're like, oh, you have, you know, they start to list everybody I had to bring into the fold. And I was like, yeah, that's why I have you two. There's, you know, this is, I come in numbers. I am not going to stand alone at this battlefield. Mm-hmm. So I shared with my sisters and then they shared with my mom. You know, and at that, when they did it, I didn't understand it. Understand why they did that. But now, like when I look back at, and the more I tell the story, the more I share my journey, they did it because they loved me and they protected me from one less person to tell. And the only other person that I had to worry about was telling my dad.
So take us back to that moment then, preparing and eventually telling your father. How was that?
Well, we were sitting in the lounge, in the house downstairs. And like I had prepared the speech over and over in my head. I was like, that's okay. You just need to just go and say it, because the siblings and my mom were taken care of and it was just my dad. So I just had to man up, you know, and this is where my faith comes in. You know, God is good. And I am so grateful that I serve a God that cares and loves me unconditionally, because he could see that I was about to do this very hard thing. And he had gone before me and he had prepared the way and made it easy. So he had gone into my dad's heart and he touched my dad's heart to say, this is going to happen. You know, whatever the conversation he had with my dad, two ways it can go, this way and that way. You know, so then I come in and my dad was really calm. I come in, we sit down, I'm like massaging his leg. And then I had a whole speech prepared and I just blurted the word out. three words, you know, I just said it. Oh, I have a girlfriend. You know, the whole speech all morning, I was like having deep anxiety about trying to explain it in the most softest way and justify it. And, you know, like, why would this happen? And nothing to worry about. And I just, this thing came out, these three words. And I was like, gosh, you could have said it differently. I said, oh, I have a girlfriend. And he was like, okay. You know, he's like, okay, are you happy? And then he said in Fijian, eh? He was like, okay, Nangulewa, are you happy? I was like, yes, Dad. He's like, okay. And the whole, and me, I'm like this. a big speech. But that is when, you know, like God came to battle for me also, because it could have gone one or two ways. I am blessed and grateful and highly favored that I have a different journey to others, you know, because I know some friends and I know some stories that it wasn't as simple as this. But I am so grateful that, like, you know, my faith played a big part in being able to be brave to tell the story. And that, like, now I look back after being, you know, out for 17 years and I see these moments. I didn't realize it then that these were moments that God had a hand in my journey. But that's what it was, because I was like, no one else would have made that easy. There's no other way, you know. And we've, like I said, I've heard stories of others that aren't as simple or aren't as kind. So, you know, I said to my dad, I was like, thank you. And I came outside and my mom and my sisters were like, so? I was like, you know what? And I just said, I was like, said this word and daddy was fine. They're like, what? I was like, what? Everybody else are waiting for one big explosion. I'm like, right? And like, after my dad, telling my dad, like telling everyone else was easier, you know, in terms of my dad's siblings and my mom's siblings, because I was like, my dad will fight for me. So I don't have to worry. I have my parents and I have my siblings. That's the most important in terms of all of it.
Incredible outcome. That,
yes.
That's so beautiful. These days, Lizzie, you know, you're very strong in your faith, as you've said. You're confident in your sexuality and have a strong sense of self, allowing you to explore stories that not only resonate with you personally, but also open the eyes of your viewers. Can you tell me, what project are you most proud of?
The biggest one that I'm most proud of is I released my documentary last September called The Forgotten Pacific. And that was about 10 years in the making. We got funding in 2019. But that went on hold because of COVID. And then we picked it up again in 2023, I think, yes. But prior to 2019, I had been kind of just jotting down ideas about this documentary in little seeds, waiting for the right time to be like, I think I'm ready to go from short form to long form. And that documentary was it for me. And to be able to travel to like the five islands that we went to in the Marshall Islands, Samoa, Vanuatu, Fiji, and Tuvalu. And with the Marshall Islands, like, my mom lives there with my baby brother and his wife and my nephews. And I got to stay with her during filming while we were there for 13 days. And I got to have breakfast every morning with my mom before I went to work and before she went to work. And the last time I did that was 2007, when I lived in Fiji before I moved, you know, so that moment, like, it will always sit in my heart. I was like, oh my gosh, I'm so blessed that my job took me here and this project took me here. My brother, baby brother, he's married to a Marshallese woman, you know, so this island became part of who I was. My dad, we scattered his ashes in the lagoon in the Marshall Islands. Like, this is part of who we are, this island. It was beautiful. I was so blessed to have been able to do that with this project. And the other island in the doco that was great was called Futuna Island. Beautiful little island in Vanuatu. They have no roads. They walk everywhere. We had to downsize our team. So it's just myself and the presenter. So I shot and did sound while she presented. And we could only, because we had to take our gear in a backpack and we had a little suitcase, we could only take like two pairs of clothes that we washed every day because we were there for 12 days.
Wow.
And we spent such a great time with this community. And like, Oh my gosh, they're so simple there, but they're so strong. They don't have a lot of reliance on kind of like the commercial world. They live off the land, literally. They fish, they walk everywhere. The kids walk to school. It takes 1 hour for the kids to walk from village to school. And they walk along like the cliff edge. One misstep, these kids could fall all the way to the bottom of, you know, so like things like this really made the documentary even more special for me. Yes, put in the stories about like the Pacific Climate Warriors and like talking about the climate struggle on the forefront, but also showcasing some of these villages and people that never get a chance to ever be seen on screen because they're too far, people say, to get to.
Lizzie, with your career and projects, it's clear that this isn't just about creating content. It's about preserving identity and building connection like you've just spoken about. At the heart of it is a real passion for showing off the rich, often overlooked creativity that's coming out of Fiji and other Pacific Islands. I'd love to hear more about that passion and what it means to you to bring Fijian stories to the forefront.
Do you know, I think it feels like my purpose and intention in this part of my career is to help create pathways that put Fiji-focused stories, because we have a lot of different creatives in the... Like Samoan, Tongan, all of our other Pacific Islands have a lot of creatives. And at Fiji, we're just a little bit behind. We've started on the back foot, but I feel like right now, like my purpose and the way that I move in my career right now is to bring more Fijian stories to screen or find more Fijian creatives and be like, let's do a theatre piece. Let's do more music videos because there's not a lot currently here in, you know, on New Zealand screens. And we have enough creatives at this level to be able to do it. Because before we didn't. We were too shy, but now we're, you know, finding our voice stronger and stronger.
Finally, Lizzie, what advice would you give to young Fijians who want to pursue storytelling, filmmaking, or any form of creative work, but they aren't sure where to start?
You know, I think people are a lot more approachable now, creatives, senior creatives who are wanting to pass on the knowledge. Just reach out, send a message, send an email, introduce yourself and just let them know what you're trying to do. If you're in the same area, neighborhood, invite them for a coffee and just chat. There's a lot more friendliness and kindness now in terms of sharing of knowledge, because that's the only way we can continue to be visible, is if we can pass on to others the tools and the skills to continue to do the same work.
Lizzie, thank you so much for joining me from Auckland and sharing your journey. Your story is powerful. It's a testament to living your truth with courage, wearing pride with honour, and having true conviction in who you are. So thank you so much. I appreciate your time, Lizzie.
Tēnā waka level, Bobby.
That was Lizzie Kuroivolo'uno, producer, director, and visual storyteller. You've been listening to Stories from the Pacific. I'm Bobby McCumber. To hear more stories about unique and incredible people from the Pacific, just search for Stories from the Pacific on ABC Radio Australia. If you or someone you know has an interesting story to share, you can email us at storiesfromthepacific@abc.net.au. This story was produced on the lands of the Yuggera and Turrbal people. I'm hosting this story on the lands of the Kaurna people.